Hello, welcome to The Rest Is History. Now, once again, we are in London. Tom Holland has roped me into one of his exciting walking tours of our nation's capital. But this time, it's a tour with a bit of a difference, because Tom, we're doing Hidden London, the secrets of London. Very exciting.
Well, what I thought was, I mean, one of the things about London, it's an unbelievably historic city. But there are lots of places where the history is kind of hidden.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, when you know what went on, when you have a sense of the kind of the ghosts that haunt it. Yeah, I mean, one of the problems with London is that although it's an incredibly historic city, there are many of the most historic corners of it where the history isn't really visible.
Yeah, so you have a track record, the Christmas Carol podcast, the Roman London podcast, of dragging me to what appear to be very yes. banal corners of the city, outside branches of coffee shops and loss adjusters' offices and things like that. And to be frank, that's where we are again. We're at a big junction, the Old Bailey. Now, the Old Bailey is very historic.
Yes.
The Old Bailey, which is the great courthouse, is nearby. There's a church. I know you love a church, so I imagine that's going to play.
And Holborn Viaduct.
But the exciting thing for me is that I don't know where we're going.
Exactly.
It's a mystery tour.
So, over the course of the lockdown, you know, you could only go out and have exercise if you went from door and out and then back to your door.
Yeah.
So we just ended up doing loads and loads of walks, and I increasingly themed them kind of around aspects of London history. So we did Roman London, we did medieval London, we did Tudor London, we did the ghosts of London, we did Dickens's London, all kinds of different themes. And I've brought you to the area of the city that had the most intersections. So if you imagine them as ley lines, this was the kind of the spaghetti junction of London psycho-geographical walks.
And as you say, I can't wait for our Chipping Norton walk, Tom.
As you say, Dominic, it doesn't look, it's not particularly picturesque.
No, it's very, very unappealing.
But, so we did a walk of Roman London.
We did.
And talked about the wall. We are on the site of one of the gates in the Roman wall. And this was Newgate. And according to our old friend John Stowe, the Elizabethan antiquarian, it was called Newgate because it was built in the reign of either Henry I or Stephen, so in the Norman period.
Was in fact the Newgate?
He was wrong. He was wrong because it is in fact a Roman gate. And from here, the road went, it's Watling Street that goes up to the Cotswolds, to your...
If you just keep
heading along Holborn Viaduct, you get back home.
So Tom, for those people who don't know London, we are still within the walls of that. Well, just by the walls of the city.
Yes. So the Roman Wall marks the line of the city of London, pretty much. So we are just on the edge of the city, and I think one of the reasons why this area of London is that we're going to go and look. So we're going to go north, away from the line of the Roman Wall, is that the stuff that went on just outside the city wall is incredibly interesting. That's part of what we're going to look at. But just a bit on Newgate. Newgate, of course, is famous as the prison.
Of course.
There was a kind of prison here from the end of the 12th century right the way up to
1902. That surprises me that it went so long. Because it's sort of very Dickensian image, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. And so vast kind of criminal complex. And the fact that the Old Bailey is there, you've got the golden statue of justice with her blindfolded with the sword and the scales of justice, is a reminder of the fact that this was the site where people were arrested, chucked into prison. And in fact, opposite us, where we're standing now, there is a pub called the Viaduct Tavern.
Yes, I was just eyeing up that pub.
And in the basement, where they store the beer...
You're a great man for a London basement, Tom.
I know, yes. Well, there are no Roman ruins here, sadly. But there are surviving cells in which debtors were kept.
And... Wow.
So they're down in the basement. So if you're ever having a drink in the Viaduct Tavern, you can ask the landlord to go and have a look. And there is apparently still a condemned man's cell on the far side. You'd be kept in that slightly larger because...
Of the Old Bailey.
Yeah, of the Old Bailey. So you get loads of visitors. People will want to see someone who's about to be hanged.
Yes, of course.
And then you'd be led along a tapering corridor. So it would get narrower and narrower and narrower as you got to the gallows. In case you kind of, you know, as the prisoner, you'd have a panic and try and run away.
So they would execute people on site?
Well, so the main execution site for a lot of the period was Tyburn Hill, which is now Marble Arch.
That's what I was
and Holborn Viaduct, you keep going on, it ends up becoming Oxford Street. So you'd be put on a tumbril and you'd be taken all this kind of about 3 miles and people would line and cheer and it'd all be a great holiday, great fun. That changed in 1783.
Right.
And we're next to a church, and basically this space here, so there's a kind of, the church is called, brilliantly, St. Sepulchre without Newgate, so outside Newgate, so we're outside the city walls here. This is where the gallows were, and it was, a huge spectacle. So Dickens came here to see it, Thackeray came to see an execution.
Dickens' descriptions of going to see executions. Well, Dickens had a real fascination for executions, didn't he?
He saw one in Rome, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Went especially to see it.
But a kind of legacy of that is that inside the church, inside St. Sepulchre without Newgate, there is an executioner's bell, which was endowed by a pious merchant in 1604. So it would sound whenever an execution was due to be held. And
To summon the locals.
Yes, to summon the locals. And these verses would be chanted. Prepare you, for tomorrow you will die. Watch all and pray. The hour is drawing near that you before the Almighty must appear. Examine well yourselves, in times repent, that you may not to the eternal flames be sent.
Well, I'd like to hear that before I'm executed.
Exactly. So I think that's all kind of very invigorating and inspiring. And the other invigorating, inspiring aspect of this corner is that here we have London's oldest water fountain.
Yeah, I've been inspecting this. So this is a, it says, the first metropolitan public drinking fountain erected on Holborn Hill in 1839, and removed when the viaduct was constructed in 1867. So there are two cups here still.
Two cups, but no water, sadly.
No. So this is sort of classic Victorian public service engineering, isn't it, the water fountain?
And it's the conjunction of gallows and temperance movement that is very, very Victorian.
Yeah, so some people presumably will be coming here to watch the execution and getting absolutely tanked up.
Yeah.
And they're putting water here to,
calm down. To try and regulate it.
Yeah.
So that's Newgate. So it's a kind of, you could... walk along here and have no sense of it, but I think once you feel it, maybe I'm being over romantic.
I think the
sense of misery and oppression does slightly ooze up out of the tarmac.
Well, maybe am I right in thinking, Tom, that this is where in the Tudor period some monks were brought here because they'd refused to swear the oath of allegiance to Henry VIII?
That's right.
So
we're going to head north now along Giltspur Street.
Yeah.
And Giltspur Street, as its name suggests, this is where they would manufacture spurs, gild them. And we're going to head up towards Smithfield, which was a huge open space outside the City of London, to which cattle would be brought from across the country. And to this day, Smithfield is still the major meat market. It's the only one that continues from the Middle Ages on the same place. But it was also in medieval times the site of the Great Priory of St. Bartholomew, and we'll talk a bit more about that when we get to it.
Yeah.
When the Priory of St. Bartholomew was closed down, there were about 10 monks that refused to take the oath of allegiance to Henry VIII, and so they were brought to...
They were starved, weren't they?
...to Newgate Jail and left to starve. And as we will see, there are quite a lot of memorials reaching back to the Tudor period, back even to the Middle Ages. And one of the reasons why it's so rich in early modern and medieval monuments is because, of course, back in the city in 1666, you had the Great Fire, which incinerated vast, huge amounts of the medieval city. But Dominic, if you look here as we come down Giltspur Street, you'll see up ahead there is a...
Cock Lane.
Up there.
It's
a golden statue of a fat boy.
This boy is in memory put up for the late fire of London, occasioned by the sin of gluttony, 1666. Yeah. You trying to tell me something, Tom?
So this golden boy marks the furthest limit that the Great Fire reached. So it swept through Newgate, up Giltspur Street, and it was stopped here.
And the sin of gluttony, is this a reference to sort of Pudding Lane, Baker's Shops? The boy at Pie Corner was erected to commemorate the staying of the Great Fire, which beginning at Pudding Lane was ascribed to the sin of gluttony when not attributed to the Papists, as on the monument. And the boy was made prodigiously fat to enforce the moral. The thing is that by today's standards, he's not really actually that fat, is he?
No, he looks quite healthy.
He was originally built into the front of a public house called the Fortune of War, which used to occupy this site and was pulled down in 1910. Now, here's an interesting thing, Tom. The Fortune of War was the chief house of call north of the river for resurrectionists in body snatching.
Yeah.
In body snatching days years ago, very strangely punctuated this, in body snatching days years ago, the landlord used to show the room where on benches around the walls the bodies were placed, labelled with the snatchers' names, waiting till the surgeons at St. Bartholomew's could run round and appraise them.
Right, because the priory is also a hospital. So St. Bartholomew's Hospital is another...
Yes, we were opposite St. Bartholomew's Hospital, one of London's most famous hospitals, probably the most famous.
Yeah, so I think this is an absolutely brilliant... This sense that, I mean, it's, again, a very anonymous corner, apart from the statue of the fat boy. You'd have no sense that this is where body snatchers were hanging out.
No, not at all. But this is actually...
And yet this is absolutely why this is such an incredibly interesting part of London to walk around. Because it's absolutely full of these kind of ghosts. And talking of ghosts, we are on the corner of a road that is very, very famous to anyone who knows about ghosts. And which featured in the wonderful episode we did on ghosts. And that is Cock Lane.
Right. Now let's talk about Cock Lane.
So Cock Lane... Obviously, that's an allusion to the butcher's produce that is here.
Right.
So there are still roads, lanes, whatever. Yeah. So
it's kind of a poulterer's lane,
I
suppose.
It's a poulterer's lane. But down there, so Cock Lane was it was a house that in the 18th century, 1762, it's probably the most notorious haunting in the whole of London's history. And it's a poltergeist which claimed to be the ghost of a woman who'd been murdered by a former lodger. And it became the biggest talking point in London. Everyone was talking about it. And people came in and started kind of finding out.
We had Roger Clark, didn't we?
We had Roger Clark telling us all about that. So if you're interested in the full story of that, go back and
listen. Dr. Johnson went and investigated it.
He did, yeah.
Not a great ghost hunter.
I think it'd be. I think we talked about what
it's a great TV series in that. And by the way, I thought of it first.
Sadly for fans of the psychic, it basically people decided it had all been a fraud.
Yeah, and actually, as streets go, it's a pretty drab and unprepossessing looking street now, isn't it?
But that's the funny thing about this
corner of London, Tom. There can be very few places in London where there's such a sort of a gulf between the romantic kind of ghost haunted memory and the frankly slightly banal reality.
And I think that is exactly what makes London's history so hard to get a grasp on.
Yeah.
It's not like going around Rome or even Paris. It's not kind of in your face.
Yeah.
But having said that, because fortunately we're now going beyond the limits of the Great Fire, there are some incredible monuments to London's past.
I look forward to it.
So I think we should head up now towards St. Bartholomew's Priory. And St. Bartholomew's Priory was founded by a man called Rahere. And Rahere was a leading courtier at the court of Henry I, so the younger son of William the Conqueror, succeeded William II, William Rufus. And some stories say that Rahere was Henry I's jester.
Oh, nice.
It'd be wonderful to think that he was. He went to Rome on pilgrimage, got sick, prayed, and a vision of St. Bartholomew came to him. He got healed, got cured, and he made a vow that he would come back and he would found a priory in a hospital. And he came back and Henry I gave him land by Smithfields, so just outside.
So outside the city.
The city. And again, when you look at the line of the Roman walls and you look at where monasteries, priories, abbeys, so on, are situated, they're next to the walls for the obvious reason that the Roman walls provided a vast quantity of building material that they could then put into it. So when the Reformation came, most of the priory got sold off, although not all of it, as we will see in due course. And the monks had run the hospital. And so people in London were kind of very worried that they'd be left without the medical services that the monks had been providing at the hospital. And so they petitioned Henry VIII to basically refound it. And so that's exactly what happened.
Unless you were one of those monks who shoved into starved to death.
Yeah, well, that's obviously, that's less good. Now, it's a shame because we're standing in front of the main entrance into St. Bartholomew's Hospital.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely covered in scaffolding.
In keeping with the spirit of this, yeah, this episode.
Exactly. Well, it's kind of, yes, a wonderful metaphor.
I shall have to use my my prodigious imagination.
Or consult the Bodleian.
Or consult the Bodleian.
Behind that scaffolding is the only statue of Henry VIII that stands in London.
And very
and
kindly,
if you want to have a look at
they have put a picture of it out on
put
the
a
scaffolding.
Of it. So we've got the fat golden boy down there, and here we've got
another fat
Henry VIII.
Yeah. So this is Henry VIII in his pomp, isn't it? It's not Henry VIII as Prince Harry. It's Henry VIII as kind of as Johnny Vegas.
Yes, this is the enema.
Yeah, enema
the enema stage. the ulcer on the leg stage. So St. Bartholomew's Hospital, still a functioning hospital.
Yep.
There were talk of closing it down, I think, about 10, 15 years ago, but it carries on. And of course, very famous, this is where William Harvey developed the
blood transfusion,
but also very, very famous for the first meeting of a celebrated fictional couple.
Of course. Watson, of course, has got back from Afghanistan.
Yeah.
He is wounded.
Yep. And Holmes is in the chemical laboratory.
And a friend, of course, says, you know, I'm going to know a guy at the hospital who is a little bit eccentric, but he's looking for someone to share rooms.
Yeah. And they meet here. And I think in the Benedict Cumberbatch update.
Yes.
This is where rather than the Reichenbach falls, he jumps off St. Bartholomew's Hospital as a tribute.
A nod, yes.
Yes, as a nod to that. So, I mean, I think anyone with an interest in London's history is glad that the hospital carries on.
Yeah.
And continues to bear the name of St. Bartholomew. Now, the priory, which we're now, you know, we're on a street, we're outside the hospital. In medieval times, the priory ran where we are walking now. We're on the open street. So we're approaching a Tudor gatehouse.
Yeah.
Which is, and you can see there's kind of you know, the essence of Tudor architecture, so black beams, white paint.
Yes.
But there's an archway beneath it, which is actually 13th century. So the Tudor gatehouse was added, obviously, in the Tudor period.
Whoa, that's top history podcasting.
And it then got covered over, and I think it got kind of rediscovered after the Blitz. So they removed the facing and discovered this kind of amazing
doorway. Yeah, it's doorway. Magnificent. Because there's very, very few buildings of that period in London, right?
Yeah, I mean, right. But we're now going to the surviving chunk of the Priory. So when the Priory... So we're now walking... We're walking through the gateway and we're walking down a pathway. And this was the nave of the priory. So this was the kind of the main body of the church.
Yeah. In traditional fashion, there's an incredibly banal office block right in the middle of what would have been the centre of the church.
Yes. But we're now approaching what is now the parish church of St. Bartholomew the Great.
Yeah.
Which preserves a section of the original priory. And it is the oldest surviving parish church in London.
It's a very handsome little church, I think.
Very, very handsome church. And it reaches back to the Norman period.
So it's got a brick tower, red brick tower.
So the brick tower is later.
Yeah.
But the main body, have you been here before?
Never.
Okay, so anyone who's seen Four Weddings and a Funeral, this is the scene of the final wedding. So it's where Hugh Grant... jilts Duckface and goes off.
This is a perfect opportunity for you to revive your Hugh Grant.
Well, gosh, is it raining?
Oh, that's so moving.
And so when you step inside,
yes,
suddenly you're back in the Middle Ages.
You are.
So on the right, as you go in, you've got a section of the cloisters, just a kind of really one of the four sides of the cloisters. But going in here, suddenly, you are in this remarkable space, and it's the meeting point. And so you come in, and you're at the interface of the Romanesque,
yeah,
which is the style of architecture that the Norman kings were sponsoring.
So there we've got those Romanesque arches and arcades and so on.
Yeah, so it's kind of narrow arches.
Yeah.
Squat arches, squat pillars. And then the place where we're standing, kind of opening up onto that space, you have the Gothic.
Yes,
and
this the is soaring the, arches.
So this and the chapel in the Tower of London is the earliest manifestations of the Gothic. And it's a kind of incredible, incredible space. And so this, you know, this is a church that is going to be 900 years old in 2023.
Yeah.
And so, as you would expect, it is just full of trace elements, memories, memorials to that history. So this font here dates from 1404. And do you know who was baptized there? There's no reason why you would. Hogarth.
Hogarth.
Who lived in the area.
So I was going to guess someone from the 15th century because you've thrown me with 1404.
Hogarth was one of the guys who was very sceptical about the Cock Lane ghost. So he's very much a guy who was hanging around in this area.
Yes.
So baptised here.
Being baptised and
very much
ghosts.
Very much a local. And if we walk down here, we come to what I think is, in a way, the most single history haunted space in the whole of London. Because, you see, we're going down the side of the, round the pillars.
So we're heading
towards the head
of the
church, behind the altar. And ahead of us is a tiny altar which shows the Virgin.
Yeah. Nice icon. Always pleased
with the baby Jesus. Now, this place here, next to the icon of the Virgin, is the only known place to have hosted an appearance by the Virgin Mary in London.
Well,
so
you're going to have to justify that claim, Tom.
So she appeared around 1180. So after the founding, you know, some kind of, what's it, kind of 70 years, 60 years after the founding of the priory. And she turned up and she spoke to a canon called Hubert and told him that the monks were doing the liturgy incorrectly. Oh. So basically, she was kind of telling them off.
Yes.
And she told Hubert what they had to do.
In English?
I imagine it was in
Latin.
Or
Norman French.
Aramaic. I mean, who knows what she was talking. I imagine
I'm
in
asking
Latin.
Too many questions.
I imagine in Latin. And so she told Hubert what he had to do, and he obediently did it, and then the Virgin Mary vanished.
Right.
And so in honour of that, they built this wonderful chapel, which is attached. It's directly behind the altar, built onto it, the Lady Chapel. Again, has a kind of huge, great picture of the Virgin behind the altar up here. But this, after the Reformation, this space all got sold off.
Yeah, because of course the reformers would not have been keen.
Yeah, so the church got so this got kept as a church to serve as a parish church. But this bit, the Lady Chapel, which was built in honour of the appearance of the Virgin Mary, that got sold off, and so it got bought up. It got used. It got turned into private accommodation. It got turned into workshops, and in the 1720s, this was a printer's, and in 1724, the printers took on a new assistant.
Can I guess who it was?
Have a guess.
Was it Benjamin Franklin?
It was, Dominic. It was.
I know more than you think, Tom.
So this space is the only place that has appeared, that's featured both the Virgin Mary and Benjamin Franklin.
And I think others. Am I not right in thinking that a dancing master was also...
Correct.
Involved with this space at some point. Did they have a dancing school or something?
So there was a dancing school here, there was a printer's, all kinds of things. And then...
Mr. Turveydrop, isn't it? From, from Bleak House.
That's right. Yeah. But the reason I love that is that, as you know, Dominic, I'm a great enthusiast for the way that Christian history has shaped the cast
of
thought.
You astound me.
And the sense of continuity between... You know, the Age of Faith and the Middle Ages and the Age of the Enlightenment.
Yes, of course.
Which many people see as being, radical discontinuity. I would see as being very much part of a continuum. And so I think that this, in terms of spaces that are haunted by the past, dancer's past. So it got bought back by the church in the 19th century.
This is the chapel on the site now is a sort of
no. This is the authentic. This space was turned into workshops.
They then got cleared out,
and it got reconsecrated, given back to the church. And the roof was about to collapse, and they had an appeal. So it opened earlier this year.
And this, of course, has been a church of notable weddings, Tom, has it not?
Well, I mentioned Hugh Grant.
You did?
Deborah Mitford got married here. So all very, very exciting. And there are two kind of interesting other highlights just to point out.
What have you got for us, Tom?
So up there, there's an oriel window, which is where the prior, just before the Reformation, built it so that he could gaze down and check that the monks were behaving themselves.
Oh, yeah, that's very
nice. So that's kind of nice. But here is the tomb of Prior Ahir, who founded
the
monastery and the hospital.
The original Roman pilgrim.
He is... So we talked about how this is an area of London that is haunted by ghosts. He reputedly literally haunts this church. Because the story goes that in the 19th century, the tomb was opened by workmen and one of them stole his sandal. And so the ghost of the...
It's a strange thing to steal.
Very strange, very strange.
A relic? No, because he's not a saint or anything. Why would you want his sandal? Dead man's sandal.
I think simply to set up the story. Right. Because I remember telling this to Roger Clark, and he turned around and said, yes, that story has appeared in about 500 iterations.
Oh, really?
So I don't think it's entirely true. It's
lovely, Tom, but is that one of those things that sometimes happens in this podcast where you tell a story that turns out to be totally untrue?
It's up to the listener to decide whether it's true or not.
Okay.
I'm not going to say whether Prior Ahir's ghost materializes on the day of his death,
and I think this,
demanding the return of his sandal or not.
Just before we go into the break, I think this church has featured in lots of films, hasn't it?
Should we go and see if there's a list?
Well, I think there may be a list. And I'm prepared to bet that this church appeared in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Well, it would be astonishing if you're
a fan
right.
of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Tom?
Yeah, I loved it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Kevin Costner didn't annoy you?
I loved its distinctive geography, going from Dover to wherever it was, London, via Hadrian's Wall.
Robin Hood films have a slightly checkered record, don't they? Because I always think of Russell Crowe's accent when he played Robin. So The End of the Affair.
Shakespeare in Love.
End of the Affair twice, it appears.
Elizabeth the Golden Age.
Sherlock Holmes. Girl. Snow White and the Huntsman.
And The Muppets Most Wanted.
Muppets Most Wanted. Well, we're big fans of
Avengers Age of Ultron.
Transformers The Last Night. We're big fans of the Muppets on this.
Yeah, we are. We love the Muppets.
So it's always good to have a Muppets-themed episode, and I'm glad to see we've ticked that box. And on that note, I think we'll go to a break, and we shall come back after the ads with some more Secrets of London. So welcome back to The Rest is History. We have just left the church. Obviously, it wouldn't have done for us to stay in the church while advertising was taking place. So we left for reasons of decorum. And now Tom has brought us outside to the site of a plaque to somebody who I know is very close to Tom's heart, a real hero of Tom's. It's to the immortal memory of Sir William Wallace. That was a very good Scottish accent.
That was fantastic. So this is where Mel Gibson.
That was basically Mel Gibson's Scottish accent.
Got hung, drawn and quartered. And the reason for that is that we are, you know, we're at Smithfield. And as we said in the first half, this is one of the great open spaces abutting the medieval walls, the medieval limits of the city. So Smithfield meant smooth field. So
yeah.
Place where, you know, all the cattle and everyone was bought. We've got the meat market over there. But because it was an open space... it could play host to all kinds of gatherings, and there was obviously no more popular excuse
for a gathering
than to watch a rebel against his anointed liege lord be tortured to death.
But Tom,
which is what happened here with William Wallace.
Have you seen the caption? You didn't write this caption, that's for sure. Scottish patriot born at Eldersley, Renfrewshire, circa 1270 AD, who from the year 1296 fought dauntlessly in defence of his country's liberty and independence in the face of fearful odds and great hardship, eventually being betrayed and brought to London, blah, 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 put to death. His heroism and devotion inspired those who came after him to win victory from defeat, and his memory remains for all time a source of pride, honour and inspiration to his countrymen.
Yeah.
That was Mel Gibson again.
Yeah,
So, Tom, you would not approve of that.
I would completely approve of it, because the great cult of William Wallace, the idea of him as a great patriotic defender of Scottish independence, yeah. was a product of the Union. It was Scots who were confident in right. their British identity, but who nevertheless were, you know, interested to But isn't to conserve the flame been, of a great Scottish hero.
Now, if you look closely, there's a smaller plaque. This memorial was placed here by Scots and friends at home and abroad by kind position of the Governor's St. Bartholomew's Hospital, 1956.
So not an age of kind of rampant Scottish nationalism.
No, but just before the revival, I suppose, of Scottish nationalism. And there are still some very desultory, there's some a few flowers here, a little card there, that's from Rod Stewart. There's a thistle.
Oh, Alex Salmond, I think.
Scottish flags.
But I mean, so essentially traitors to the king would, you know, this was one of the places where you would come to watch a good hanging, drawing and quartering. So the guts would then join all the guts from the butchers. And they would then be swept into the River Fleet, which is over there, which we may come to in due course. So the stench of this was kind of overpowering in the Middle Ages. And actually, you know, among the ghosts that haunt this place are literary ghosts, ghosts from fiction. And one of them is Pip in Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, who, when he comes to London, goes to the offices of Mr. Jaggers, the lawyer who has been entrusted with his, you know, the legal details of his inheritance, his Great Expectations. And it's just down there, just the side corner. So between the hospital and the church, there's a side alley called Little Britain. And that's where he had his offices. And Dickens says that Pip comes here from the country and he walks up towards Jaggers' office and the stench from the meat market kind of makes him almost faint.
Well, market is still here. I mean, we're within sight of the market.
But there isn't kind of stench. There's no stench. But so disembowelings happened here, but other things happened as well. And among the things that happened here, people would congregate for great kind of festive occasions, great social occasions, of which the preeminent one was St. Bartholomew's Fair.
Yes, of course, very famous.
Very, very famous. Established by the Priory in 1123. Site of, you'd have tournaments here as well. So
there was
a famous tournament under Richard II that Chaucer played a key role in organising. But you would also have meetings that weren't necessarily sanctioned by the Crown.
Yeah.
And the most famous of those is when the peasants who were embroiled in the peasants' revolt marching on London, they all congregated here.
They did indeed, didn't they? Isn't this the showdown?
This is the showdown, and led by Wat Tyler.
Yeah.
And Wat Tyler gets struck down here by the Lord Mayor of London.
He does, yes, because he doesn't show enough deference to Richard II.
And so it's
so there's a very new plaque here.
Well, it's a plaque raised to the memory of the peasants who took part in the revolt.
And what some people might consider classic sort of radical tradition, it's been placed slightly too high, so you can't really read what's at the
top. The memory is already fading. The William Wallace one is much clearer.
Yeah.
But there's something here. What does it say? It's something about the plight of the people.
This is a terrible metaphor for the plight of the British left. Yeah. I think it's very hard to see what's.
There's a mention of Wat Tyler being killed here, and of John Ball, who preached the
when Adam delved an Eve span,
who then was the gentleman. Yeah.
So this was unveiled by Ken Loach, among other people. And there's a quote here from Thomas Paine on a plaque. If the barons merited a monument to be erected at Runnymede, that's a reference to Magna Carta, Tyler merited one in Smithfield, Thomas Paine, 1791. Of course, the great thing about this is it's all a kind of invention, like Magna Carta, it's kind of an invention, isn't it? The Peasants' Revolt isn't a kind of proto-socialist uprising, really. But it's become part of that kind of invented radical tradition, I suppose.
Yeah, and that, again, absolutely is part of the fascination of London's history. It's that the memories of what happened here don't have to be accurate for them themselves in turn to become part of history, part of the flow of it.
I think Jeremy Corbyn has been here, Tom. I would like to do a little pilgrimage in the footsteps of Corbyn.
well, you know, there's something for all tastes here. So there's something for Scottish nationalists, there's something for members of Momentum, and there's something for radical Protestants.
Because very good.
Here there is a third memorial.
Yeah.
Which was erected 1870 by the Protestant Alliance in London.
That's
a sort of
evangelical group, I
guess so. And that commemorates the... so we've had disembowelings, but most notoriously in the reign of Queen Mary, there were the burning of heretics. So the burnings that took place here are essentially what gave Mary the First her nickname of Bloody Mary. And the great theme of Fox's Book of Martyrs, this sense that the revival of Catholicism would mean Protestants being burnt in Smithfield, haunted the imaginings of Protestants throughout the late 17th century.
Within a few feet of this spot, says the memorial, John Rogers, John Bradford, John Philpot, and other servants of God suffered death by fire for the faith of Christ in the years 1555, 1556, 1557. Now, of course, since we were revisionist about the Peasants' Revolt, we should also be a little bit revisionist about Bloody Mary, who gets a bit of a bad press, doesn't she? Because, you know, burning heretics was hardly unusual behaviour in the 16th century. And some people would argue she was just unlucky in her posthumous reputation.
Yeah, I mean, had she lived a bit longer...
Yeah,
I'm sure.
And had Catholicism become enshrined, once again, no one would say it was...
History would remember it very differently.
Know,
just where we're standing, in 1849, some workmen were digging a sewer. As they were digging it, they found a mass of blackened stones. And these, it was claimed, were covered with ashes and human bones, charred and partially consumed. And an antiquary came to inspect it and had absolutely no doubt that he was gazing at the remnants of the incinerated Protestant martyrs.
All those years later?
Again, Dominic, you're...
I'm much too sceptical.
You and your scepticism towards these wonderful stories. There's one on the subject of horrendous occasions from the past that commemorate in open spaces. There's one other. We won't go and look at it now because we haven't really got time. But around the corner on the other side of the meat market, there's an open space, Charterhouse Green, which was originally a plague pit during the Black Death. So they were developing the tube line and they discovered all the bones came tumbling out. Charterhouse Green subsequently... There was a priory was founded there, Carthusians, again in the Reformation, all got sold off, became a famous school that then moved out. One of the more famous private schools, isn't it? So Charterhouse. Don't know where it went, but is it?
Surrey? Godalming.
Godalming, okay.
I have an encyclopedic knowledge of public schools.
Well, very impressive.
Someone has to.
So essentially, I mean, this, you know, the sense of history here is kind of... almost oppressive, and unless you knew to look, to go through that gate yard, to go into St. Bartholomew the Great, to know what happened in St. Bartholomew's Hospital, and certainly to know what happened in this open space.
That's
what Tyler,
thing, though,
William
Tom.
Wallace,
it's the combination
Protestant
of
martyrs.
The banality of the modern day landscape with the layering of, frankly, a very bloody and violent history, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, you know, people are bustling, well, they're not even bustling about, actually. A few people are sort of trudging in a slightly disconsolate way past at the end of the day from their office on their way to the commute home.
And the memories are preserved in the street name.
Cloth
so we're going
fair.
Past,
we're walking
cloth
past Cloth
Fair now. Yeah. There's one last place I'd like to,
okay, but
to take you to.
Do you think, I mean, probably there's never been a point in the history of this part of London where it has been quieter and more desultory than it is now. Do you think?
I think that's
so
true.
For so much of its history, this was a bustling, you know... It would have been, maybe the analogy is if you were to visit a city like, I don't know, Delhi or Istanbul or something, crowded, you know, rich and poor, jumbled up together, hawkers in the streets, pickpockets.
Yeah, with the prospect of a good execution.
Yes.
I mean, there's no prospect of that now.
No, so in many ways London has gone downhill.
I think it's less interesting. But that's precisely what history podcasts are for.
To bring back the spirit
to
of bring,
to conjure up, to conjure up the vanished ghosts.
Yeah.
And actually, what gives you a very good sense of just how horrible this place would have been is that we're now walking parallel to the great Victorian structure of the meat market, away from the open space where the burnings and the disembowelings happened, and we're going downhill. And the reason that we're going downhill is that we're plunging into a river valley. And the river that we're heading towards is the River Fleet.
So that is, now, for those people who don't know, the Fleet is probably the most famous, isn't it, of London's vanished rivers. So the Fleet gives its name to Fleet Street, which is obviously So probably not anymore, yeah. But for certainly when we were growing up, was synonymous with newspapers. And when did the fleet vanish, Tom?
Well, it starts to get covered over 17th, 18th, as late as the 19th century, you could still sail up a section of the fleet. But the value of the fleet, and one of the other reasons why the meat market is here, is that you could sweep the carcasses, you know, so all the guts that you've hacked out when you're doing your joints, you could just sweep it into the river.
So some listeners may remember we had a podcast about disease with Kyle Harper, and he was talking about, you know, cholera and dysentery and all these things, and he would not be impressed.
No,
by the standards of hygiene.
No. Well, and there are three very famous lines by Jonathan Swift, who wrote about the fleet. Sweepings from butcher's stalls, dung, guts and blood, drowned puppies, stinking sprats, all drenched in mud, dead cats and turnip tops come tumbling down the flood.
Well, anyway, this podcast is sponsored by the London Tourist Board. I mean, to be fair, there's no evidence of that right now.
So the fleet was by this stage, was, you know, until it got covered over, was quite broad. So Fleet Street, where it crosses the River Fleet just in front of St. Paul's Cathedral, Ludgate Hill, that was a ford. So that was the reason it's called Fleet Street, is because you could cross the fleet there.
Right.
But it all got covered over. And you remember we started this episode on Holborn Viaduct.
We did indeed.
And the viaduct is basically built over the river valley of the fleet. And the fleet marks one of the kind of, the, you know, one of the urban boundaries. And it's on the other side of the fleet. I just want to show you one last kind of place of horror.
Ah, Tom, you lure me up to London with these
But I think you'll enjoy it because it's a fictional place of horror.
Right. Very good.
And we've already mentioned...
I like any place of horror, factual or fictional, to be honest with you.
We've already mentioned the novelist who created this fictional place of horror.
Oh, excellent.
And it is, of course, Charles Dickens. And the place that we're heading towards is the place where the young Oliver Twist, when he comes to London, gets picked up by artful Dodger.
Please, sir, I want some more. Is that what people will be saying at the end of this podcast, Tom?
I certainly hope so. And he gets taken by the artful Dodger to visit a pleasant old gentleman and his hopeful pupils. And of course the pleasant old gentleman is Fagin, and the hopeful pupils are the pickpockets. So we're coming down now to, well, it's now a major road, but the River Fleet runs beneath it, and we cross there, and then we will come to Saffron Hill.
You're never happier. Listeners to our Christmas Carol podcast will know that you're never happier than when bringing us to the dingiest, dreariest spot imaginable.
And we're coming down some steps here, and there's a stream of dog urine.
Yeah. There's a DHL van.
Dripping down the steps.
We're at the back of some sort of loading bay. Yeah. It's the most unromantic corner of London you could possibly imagine.
So this is Saffron Hill.
Which definitely does not live up to its surname.
Well, so this was all part of owned by the Bishop of Ely. So you remember in our Richard III episode, we talked about how Richard of Gloucester, before having Hastings beheaded, asked the Bishop of Ely for strawberries from his garden.
He did indeed. Yes.
So the Bishop of Ely's garden was kind of in this neighbourhood. And it's Saffron Hill because saffron grew here. Now, as you say, there's no trace of saffron now.
No.
Yeah, so we kind of very. It's very narrow. There are very high buildings on either side.
Blank buildings. Yeah, I mean, wouldn't bring people sightseeing here.
Kind of gloomy and miserable. But this is where Fagin's lair was, and I know that you're a big Dickens fan. So perhaps you have.
I have a little reading here.
Perhaps you have a little reading that you'd like to share with the
readers.
You
didn't expect that. Well, actually, you did, because you put it in the notes. So here we go. Oliver could not help bestowing a few hasty glances on the other side of the way as he passed along. A dirtier or more wretched place he had never seen. The street was very narrow and muddy, and the air was impregnated with filthy odours. They've played quite a considerable part in this episode. There were a good many small shops, but the only stock in trade appeared to be heaps of children, who even at that time of night were crawling in and out of the doors or screaming from the inside. the sole places that seemed to prosper amid the general blight of the place were the public houses, and in them, Tom Holland, the lowest orders of Irish, who are generally the lowest orders of anything, were wrangling with might and main. I hope my wife isn't listening to this. Covered ways and yards, which here and there diverged from the main street, disclosed little knots of houses where drunken men and women were positively wallowing in the filth. And from several of the doorways, great ill-looking fellows were cautiously emerging, bound, to all appearance, upon no very well-disposed or harmless errands.
Yes.
So there we are.
And so you mentioned the taverns, and one last link with Oliver Twist is ahead of us. There's a pub that is now called the One Ton, but Dickens knew as the Three Cripples.
The Three Cripples. You wouldn't get away with that.
And that's Fagin and Bill Sykes' local. So that's where they...
And there's some sort of lightly looking Bill Sykes figures.
Yes.
Lurking outside the pub.
Yes, there are dogs on binder twine.
Yeah.
Plotting break-ins in... So I hope you agree, Dominic, that although there may not be a huge amount to see... It is.
Well, there's nothing to see, Tom.
Well, there's a tavern. But, I mean, it's once you know...
Yeah, once you know.
This is Fagin's Lair.
You have to know. And there's a message here I think you have for the listeners, Tom. They should venture out and dig up the layers of history beneath even the most unprepossessing neighbourhood.
Well, the thing is that it's true of London. It's true of lots of places.
Stevenage. Of Slough.
Maybe not of Slough, but of lots of places that, you know, obviously the more you know of what goes on,
yeah,
the more you have a sense of the past oozing up out of the tarmac, out of the brickwork.
Like the bowels of some dismembered Scot.
Indeed.
Flung
into the Fleet.
Well, on that note.
Wash away with the dogs.
I think it's just about beginning to rain. So on that note, I think we should say farewell to our listeners.
Yes.
And we will see you next time. And Tom.
Farewell from London Town.
Fancy a quick pint?
Yeah, let's go.